Welcome to the Knock on Archery podcast, where we bring all archers and bow hunters together from all walks of life with the goal to educate, empower, and inspire you to be better both in the field and on the range.
Dude, old school. This was our way to go back in the day. This is where the cleared hop began. You're the one that dialed me in on these, too.
Not with this. This is like Abe Lincoln riding on a coal shovel.
We both had these same setups, you idiot.
Oh, that Zoom was the one I did start with.
I know.
Which one's that, though? The four? I was probably the six, though, because that's the four. Yeah, that's the four.
Because I think I had like a big old cat mic. Like, remember when me, you, and Tosh did that podcast down in Texas like forever ago? We did a podcast at that round poker table over in where Tosh was sleeping.
I vaguely remember that, and probably because we drank the bourbon with White Monster.
That's where Gutshot was created.
That is what it was called. God, what a horrible drink. And by that, I mean amazing.
I still feel a little guilty on that, the whitetail backstrap switcheroo we did on everyone there.
Why? What's in the past is in the past.
Oh, full backstory on that one. I think I went a little too deep telling everybody how unbelievable Mouflon was, because in Hawaii when I had it with...
It was not good.
When I had it with Remy and Dorian and everybody in Hawaii, it was amazing. And it was...
Why, though?
I think it was just like eating its native like vegetation and everything. And then it's kind of the same with Axis. To me, Axis in Texas don't taste like Axis that's in...
Are you sure you didn't get backstrap swindled when you were in Hawaii?
I mean, it's possible. It's possible.
Sharon's calling.
I'm not answering that. I'm not answering that.
That's your call.
So I told everybody at this Texas deal how amazing Mouflon was, because we were there with some first-time bow hunters. Remember, we were there with some vets that were doing archery for the first time, so we were kind of hunting exotics.
How long ago was that? I feel like it was 15 years.
I feel like it was 2018, probably.
My math's not great.
Because that was Tosh's first bow hunt, too, I think.
I think you were sighting in his bow with him and doing your kind of your controlling what's in the box series that morning when we went hunting.
And that's when I really talked up how amazing these Mouflon backstraps are going to be.
Did he shoot the Mouflon or did I? Because I got a goat too, right? Or a sheep?
I'll be honest,
I don't know the difference between a sheep and a
goat.
That's
when things got really personal between you and that one we called Sniper.
Remember,
old Eagle Eyes? And then I ended up smoking his butt.
Which one did I get? Because I ended up getting one from that.
Yeah, we all got some. I'm trying to think. I don't know. I can pull up the pictures. But I had convinced everybody that
it's a
Mouflon backstraps. Yeah.
Okay.
That they were the best thing that I had ever ate. So I took mine out of the Mouflon that was shot, and then we went on to cook. You and I cooked it while the rest of the guys were over at the skinning house.
Yep. We placed it with whitetail backstraps.
Yeah, and then I'm like, I go, should we have like the first bite? And you're like, heck yeah, let's do it. And that's when we were deep in the monster bullet bourbon is what it was.
For those of you who want a special type of ride, it's a white monster, not sponsored by them in any way, shape, or form.
Definitely not.
And I think it's the only time I've ever had one of their beverages, but if you mix it with bourbon, it was just those two, right? Was there a third?
Yeah, it's called Gutshot, I think is what you called it.
It's gonna sound horrible up front. But it's actually really good.
Yeah.
And it will
take It's business you on a ride. In the front and party at the back.
It is business in the front for
it's
sure.
The mullet of cocktails.
It'll get you where you need to be.
Depending
on where you need that to be.
We had one taste of that crap and then we ended up, I said, dude, sneak down there. You snuck down to the meat locker and cut some whitetail backstraps out. And then we ended up replacing them.
I'm trying to look for the same picture.
I'm trying to look for it, yeah. Maybe it was 19 with Todd.
I don't know. Does it seem to you as you get older, time is passing faster?
Oh, yeah, big time. There he is. Okay, here we go. January 2019.
Yep.
Dude, Tosh didn't have one single piece of camo that matched. And he was, of course, in his Crocs. Crocs, washed out real tree pants, brush country button-up shirt, another type of Carhartt camo hat, and then a Mossy Oaks hex suit.
Yeah, Carlos Hathcock's sniper hat from Vietnam.
Oh, you did shoot a MUFON. It was.
Is yours. That what it was?
Yeah, remember? I remember your shot now. You shot that sucker up that hill.
Yeah.
That was awesome. That was such a fun hunt, too.
Yeah, he went and died right by the road. Our stalk was amazing. We found a dirt road and walked it, and then there it was.
Yeah, and that's when Sniper went down.
Yeah. Their eyes, man.
They can see everything. Remember, we actually, in that podcast, we talked about how valuable going on a exotic ram, like, you know, honestly, Audads, Texas Dolls, like any of those types of sheep.
I've never hunted any of those.
If you're able to spot and stalk those, you could easily do a mule deer hunt. I mean,
I don't know.
We put on a lot of miles chasing that one around. Lots of miles.
Yeah. We put on a lot of miles chasing all sorts of things around. Because you let me loose one day by myself, and I was like, I know what the deal is. Constant movement. That's how you hunt these things.
That's the one time that I actually would have saw value in a three-arrow quiver. Because I would have gave it to you and been like, okay, how much trouble can he actually get in if he's only got three?
A lot, because it's coming back empty.
Yeah, but that's still half the trouble that you would get in with six.
I know. I like the six-arrow ones better, though. I figure if you shoot one, shoot them all.
Our schedules have gotten wild. What do you miss? I feel like there was a time where you and I just kind of were able to...
Dude, we hunted so much the first few years we were hanging out. It's what sucks for me is I tell myself every year, like September, October, I'll just carve it out. I'll be ready to go. And then part and parcel, 24-hour or 48-hour blocks at a time, it starts getting carved up. And before you realize it, then there's the travel in between those things. And then somebody hits you up with an opportunity. You're like, I can't.
Yeah.
I'd have to miss three other things, which I can't back out of because I committed to it. It sucks. And so actually, I mean... I love shooting my bow, but last year I think I had 7 total days. And when I have 7 days, the 300 Win Mag comes out and it eats.
I think that'll come out at any time.
The fucking ground.
How cool was your elk hunt?
Well,
because you shot a monster in Wyoming.
And I'm not going to say it was difficult. It was the first elk that I saw. And I saw it within 5 minutes of being there. I never told you the story, did I?
And was it like extreme distance right away or?
No. So we had, I don't know if you haven't met him yet. His name is CJ and he is, and if CJ, if I'm getting these details incorrect, it's not because I'm trying to, it's the best of my knowledge. He manages the land out in Wyoming. It is, I believe it's either coal or oil and gas. They own the land. And I don't think they actually mine it anymore, but it's a very, like, tens of thousands of acres. So it is private land. It's not fenced by any stretch. Actually, I take that back. They're property fences, but, like, the little three-strand stuff, which I have now seen that elk do not care about.
Yeah.
They will go through that, over that. They don't. They're just like, whatever, get out of my way. And he actually donates a tag to me. I think it's from his family. He can sign it over because of the 100% disability. And he reached out over the internet. And the first time I went out there was actually with Riley for a cow tag on the property.
Oh, yeah.
So we see this. We're driving around. It's in a side-by-side. And I was messing around with the 6.5 Creedmoor for the first time. So this was 3 years ago. And we come up, and there was a herd of elk hopping one of these barbed wire fences, which I don't even think they break stride to do.
No,
they're just right over the
top.
That's
nothing.
Riley peels out of the side-by-side and gets into stare down with like this 5x5, the first time he'd ever seen an elk, and he was just like vapor locked, staring at this thing. I knew I didn't have a bull tag, so I start running down this little finger as they were coming around. I'm loading the rifle, dialing my dope, popping over the scope covers, get on a knee, and I'm just holding in this window that I knew that they were going to cross, and one walks in front of it. I'm like, you're done. Just lung matter, like right there, the first, and it was downhill like 50 yards. CJ was like, all right. That was good. Most people wouldn't be able to do all those at one time. Like, it's like putting a shoe back on.
Yeah, yeah.
The next year, he had a maintenance tag. So it had to be 5 or less on one side, which I tell you what, is not easy to find.
Yeah, I know.
I did not know that. I just figured like, oh, yeah, we'll definitely see. And it could have actually been broken off too. So if it would have been a 6x6 but with a tine broken off, I guess that would have counted. But I took Leah with me, and you know this, but I am really good at calling elk. And
for sure, most people do.
The cow call that I have now, it brings that milkshake brings the ladies to the yard, which is like it's straight off the shelf. I don't even know if I'm using it properly. But I was cow calling, and Leah had never been around elk, and this sucker came from hundreds of yards away, straight up at us, 6x6, but it stayed at like 30 yards for about 5 minutes, and it was so I was so happy. That was the first hour of the hunt from the year before, and I was stoked from that point on, because she's just sitting there looking at it, and I was looking at it and cow calling at it just to see what it would do. But it was cool to see how where they heard it from, and that thing, it had four other cows, and it just on a rope up the hill.
It's so funny that how that switch is on sometimes, and then it's off most of the time, but sometimes it is just instant.
Yeah, and did not find something with five or less that day. Did not find something with five or less the day after. We were having great elk interaction, but it just... And I was terrified, too. I'm sitting there looking at it through the blind. I was like, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. CJ, count that. Because I don't want to mess up. I mean, it's great to have the tag. The third day, had some really cool elk interactions. They weren't bugling. I would cow call to, like, mess around. And, like, 5 minutes later, you'd just see a head peeking out. It was really weird. They were coming in quiet. I was like, oh, shit. Then they would walk up, and we had one wind us, and we kind of went over this other finger. And CJ was like, dude, there's a 5x5 right there. Okay, we each counted it like three times just to be sure. Yeah. Like one, are you sure? I'm sure. I see 5x5. So I shot that thing, 301 mag. Theory was it was still standing, so rounds continued to fly.
You definitely keep that theory intact for no matter what the weapon choice.
Yeah, I don't have a choice. Yeah, really arduous hike out there. He went and got a tractor, and we flipped it over into the bucket and then drove it back to camp. Super arduous. And then last year, he had an unrestricted tag. So we go out there. Leah knew where we were going to go. It's a really cool area. It's kind of out in the middle of nowhere. I had the Starlink set up. Otherwise, there's no comms of any kind, but which is also one of the things I love about hunting, as well as the fact there is no comms.
Yeah, the disconnect is great.
So that trip before... I swear to God, I think Leah is more fired up about shed hunting than actual hunting.
I mean, it's the first thing she mentioned when we walked in the house.
So we're sitting there, and I tell you what, she can actually spot animals better than I can, and she can pick out sheds under binoculars. And we're sitting there, saw one across a ravine, probably 600 to 800 yards away. It was sun bleached, but it was sitting there. So we went over there and got that, and she's just like hiking the rest of the day with this. And this ties into the story because we drive to this point and we stopped right before we could see over the top so we didn't blow ourselves out from things being able to see us. The second that we are out of the side-by-side, she finds like the right-hand side of a 6x6 just laying there. She's like, oh, my God. I'm like, okay, she's going to be busy for a few minutes. So I walk forward. I can see elk out, and I lift up my binoculars, and I was like, okay, that's pretty big, but it's CJ's call. I mean, he manages the property. He looked at it. He goes, yeah, that thing definitely should die. Like, oh, you are speaking my language. He had about 10 cows, and they were feeding around a corner or like a little finger, and CJ is an expert at the property. He said there's one of two places they're going to go. He might hook in and be a little bit shallow, or he might go around that first place he could hook in and end up a little bit farther down. So let's just go down, and we'll wait. But this, like, I saw that elk within 5 minutes of being out of the side-by-side. On our way out, Leah finds the other side of that matching pair of the 6x6.
Jeez.
And a muley. And so, I mean, her grin lasted for days. We go around, and we wait, and about an hour and a half before sundown, we're kind of just sitting there looking, and here come the cows first. And so there he came out, and we went down a little bit of a hill to close, but took about 150 yards off of it. So I think the shot was maybe 500, low 500s. I get lined up, I'm laying and watch him. And right before I'm getting ready to shoot, he sits down. He just lays down. And I had been around elk enough, or just animals at this point. he was in front of his cows and they were kind of feeding past. And yeah. I knew at some point there was going to be a distance where he would stand up.
Yeah.
So I'm lazing in front of him, behind him, left. I'm like, okay, if he gets up and goes left, I'm going to shoot him here. If he stands up. And then in my head, I'm thinking, if he doesn't stand up, I'm shooting him in the face.
Yeah, I was going to say.
If he doesn't stand up, I will intentionally shoot one right over his face or in his face to get him to stand up. And then we're going to play that game. So I have like this beautiful range card in front of me. There's no direction he can go where my dope isn't already dialed. And I'm just laying behind the gun for probably 30 minutes, totally relaxed, low heart rate. And right what I thought the cow was kind of fed by. And you could tell he was kind of turning his head and watching him a little bit more. And then the next thing you know, he starts standing up, turns completely broadside. So his right side is right there next to me, and squeeze off a shot. And he hunched up and I could see it. Reloaded, and I think he had taken two more steps, still standing, so he got shot again. Both of them in the lungs, and he just tipped, and it was the biggest elk I've ever shot, for sure. It was a true 7x7.
Yeah, because was mine a 7, too, or was mine an 8? I'm sure mine was bigger than yours. It normally is.
Generally, yeah, and you do it with a bow, which is much harder than a rifle. That rifle hunting is easy, but it is easier than bow hunting, just because of the distance.
I remember you sending me that thing. You're like, I got an elk. I don't know. It was the first one I saw. What do you think? And I was just like, what a jackwagon.
It was the first one I saw.
I'm like, dude, that thing is sweet. That is really, really nice. Let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yeah, 7. We both shot 7x7s. That's right. I thought so. I thought you were like, dude, I shot a 7x7. And I was like, I shot a 7x7.
I don't know if you have obviously had substantially more elk interactions than I have. That actually might be the first one that I've seen. It doesn't seem like they're that common.
They're not common to me, that's for sure.
Have you ever seen an 8x8?
Yeah, I've saw one. Yes, I have seen one. Yeah, I think I've seen an 8x9. There's some honker bulls up in British Columbia, too, by the way. Some of those areas where they weren't open to be able to hunt for a long time.
Are they symmetrical, though, or do they start getting a little bit weird with the genetics?
I mean, they're not.
Like, the
first
bull I shot up there had that little bat. You know what I mean? It was, like, straight up in a basket.
Yeah.
So there was some weird genetics.
I've never seen, like, a real, legit, full, like, 8x8 that's, like, a total typical looking.
Yeah.
Normally it's like they'll grow the eighth and then you'll have like another flyer off a royal tine or something like that. Or they'll have like a devil's tine up front to kind of kick them over the edge. But that bull I shot and your bull were both just super symmetrical sevens.
He was yeah. And the beauty was as soon as CJ saw him, he was like, it needs to die. I'm like, say no more.
Yeah. Done.
Put me in a place where I can shoot this thing. It was funny. Actually, before he came around, another bull came around that was shootable too. So we went down the hill and we're looking. I'm like, oh, that's just a 6x6. So we went back up the hill, turned around, and then the other one came out. So we went back down the hill again.
When we were in Alberta that first time, I mean, we did so many freaking miles. It seems like
the very first hunt?
Yeah.
With our black bear adventures?
Yeah. Oh. That was awesome, though. I feel like that hunt solidified our partnership.
For sure. You know what I've thought about many times since then? I don't know if I brought this up to you. I didn't realize how dangerous moose are. And when we stumbled across that cow moose that was not far from us.
Oh, yeah.
I thought it was just going to lope off. I had no idea how gnarly those things were. I was like, oh, okay, whatever. It's just a moose.
Yeah, I mean, if you would have got much closer to that calf, there was going to be some stomping going on.
Yeah, no, have you seen the videos of the moose, like, breaking the snowmobiler's leg? Sitting there just stomping him, and somehow his leg comes out to the side, and it's like, oh, really? Right in the middle of it, just...
That's a classic move.
Well, and the first few stops got the job done, but that moose stayed. It was savage. It was just like, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah.
I was way more worried about the grizzly, bro.
Oh, the one I wanted to throw the rock at?
Yeah. I remember you guys went in front of us. We were getting our gear ready, and I'm like, you guys go ahead. And I said, sometimes there's elk up in that corner, because it was like, I'm sure it was dark when we first got there, right? And I'm like, get up into that thing, because a lot of times the elk will be exiting that corner.
Yep.
And then someone else was with us too. And I remember I kind of come lagging up the back, and I didn't want to like wreck what was going on. And then someone like comes back and they're like, oh, Andy and Caleb are on a stock with like a really cool color phase bear. And I had seen all the grizzly tracks in that area. So I was like,
meanwhile, my bear knowledge is zero.
Yeah. Your bear knowledge was
literally zero.
Yeah.
I mean, zero. I knew what bears were and I had seen them in zoos.
And I kind of got close enough to where I could look at you with binoculars because it was in wheat, right? Tall mm-hmm. wheat.
Yeah.
And I could see the hump sticking out of the wheat because he was laying down eating originally, right? And you guys thought it was just a big color phase black bear that was on its legs eating.
Let's be very clear. I didn't know what the hell it was. I knew it was a bear. You're like, oh, I saw the hump. Yeah, I saw it too and registered absolutely nothing about that.
I come running in. I'm like, number one, do not shoot that thing. Number two, let's get out of here before. And you're just like, why? And I'm like, it's a grizz. And you're like, what does that mean? Well, I mean, it means we're 30 yards from it and it might be pissed once it gets up and realizes what's going down.
It looked like it was happy at the time.
We were in the middle of nowhere too. If that thing had decided, well, obviously Caleb was dead. You and
Jordan.
I would have been fine.
Yeah. We could outrun Jordan. He was wearing his muck boots and his onesie.
That's right. That was during that era.
Yeah.
Well, I think he's still in that era now.
But the very first animal we encountered on that trip, though, was that moose and the calf. I had no idea.
That's right. Because the first day, we hiked that big ridge back. Wasn't it wet? It was really raining or something, too. And that's kind of why we got so close to that thing. Because all of a sudden it just heard a snap and it, like, stood up. Yeah, that was the beginning of a...
It was a good 7 days.
It was a good 7 days. It really was. That was so awesome. I just love the Canadian trips. Really. I mean, two of my trips every year are to Canada just because that wilderness is just so amazing. It's awesome to be a place where you can get multiple tags and you're just hunting the backcountry. You know, they call it the bush.
Yeah.
But you're just hunting up there and you don't really know what you're coming across. And so, you know, well, after that year, I started getting a moose tag every year just to have it. Just to have it in my pocket. Because it's not common you're going to see them in August.
Yeah.
Unless you kind of stumble upon them like that.
Yeah, I was going to say, they're still there. They're just quiet.
Yeah. And the bull that I got in Velvet last year, I think. I thought it was last. No, it might have been the year before.
An Alberta bull.
It was an Alberta.
Okay.
It was right there. It was in that same block of timber where you and Caleb and Jordan got your elk after you got the shits.
Shit went down in that shire. Shit went down.
I remember knowing that you guys had gone in to like, you know, I got like a message like they're over in this area. They're like going in to recover Andy's bull. So I told Dusty and Jeremy, you know, let's freaking go help them get this thing out. And we could see your tracks like where the like along the edge of that timber, we could see where you'd walked in the dew. Cause that's one thing you can expect up there is like really wet feet every morning. Cause of how much dew there is, it just wicks through your whole system. And, we go back there and I don't know how close we were to you. I just remember at one time through the timber, hearing Jordan yell, "Stop, Andy, stop shooting." It's like,
it was still moving.
Something got Western back here. That's where I got my moose. Like right in that area is where I got my moose. It was a really rainy day, just like the first day we hunted together when we saw the cow. Mm-hmm. And we were just, it was like windy and rainy. So I just said, let's still hunt all that bedding. So we just literally just kind of, you know, packed our stuff and just, we were just going to spend the whole day back there. And it's so swampy that actually you kind of need that weather to not die from malaria from the mosquitoes too. And so next thing I know, I like see this thing move around. I'm like, holy crap, bedded freaking moose. And he was bedded, never heard us. We were 50 yards from him. So we kind of get all set up and stuff. And I was trying to like stand up on a log and it like broke. And then that sound made him stand up, and then the bull like looked our way, but then all of a sudden he looked to the left. But I'm so focused on like trying to find a lane, I didn't realize a like massive one popped out like 20 yards to my left, just like came out of the willows and was just standing there looking at us like a
Big old paddles.
Yeah, like a big 40-50 incher, like a giant in velvet. And I kind of look over to Jeremy to make sure he's filming this, you know, bullwinkle that I'm on, and his camera's kind of pointing over there, and I'm like, get on him, dude. And he kind of like looks at me, and then he like goes and I was just like, are you on him? He's like, yeah. And I shot, and then, you know, we heard him crash in like 5 seconds, and then he just looked at me, he goes, did you not see the one to your left? And I go, no. And he goes, dude, the one to your left was like 40 to 50 inches full velvet just staring at you at 25 yards. And I'm like, what, where? And he's like, he freaking freaked out right when you let one rip on this other
shocker
one. Yeah,
well, yeah, when you're looking through the peep, you're not seeing the whole world.
But that was an awesome day too. That was so fun.
That's a great place.
It really is.
Did you go with the same outfit, the Red Willow?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool, man. I don't know. I feel like it, loyalty to hunting friends is more important than almost any type of loyalty that you have. You know, it's like if people take you to one of their spots, or if people like get a tag for you, or like, you know, in that case, you have to use an outfitter in Canada as a non-resident. Yep. So we need an outfitter in order to be able to hunt there. So if that outfitter is like, we'll hold a tag for you every year for that week.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I'm all in.
Yeah.
And I love, honestly, I love the fact that, you know, kind of like at the beginning when we were talking about that awesome hunt you had in Wyoming, which sounds like an amazing place. I'm fortunate to get invited on some really awesome spots too,
yep.
But not all of them. And for me to go and to do like, to start out the first 2 weeks of the year up there hunting, you know, a lot of public land, you know,
Crown land.
Or, you know, I've been up there for so many years, a couple decades that I've knocked on a lot of doors and met a lot of people. And typically that first day up there is just driving around, getting acquainted, making sure the same person owns that land or not. And, you know, hey, I'm here again this year. Is there any way? Just being able to walk through somebody's property to get to any of the timber, really is most of it's bush, most of it's crown land. But just to be able to walk across, you know, the edge of an ag field to fall into the river basin is saves you miles.
That terrain up there will chew you up too.
Yeah, it'll chew you up, and it normally chews half your equipment off you at the same time.
That's why you got to take six.
that was so fun. I feel like the fact that we nuked everyone around us just made us love that trip so much more.
That was amazing. Yeah, people were at the edge of their comfort level for sure.
Have you done any other cool ones without me?
I did the Utah hunt 2 years ago. I wasn't able to go there last year. I've done some just very basic Montana public land hunting. This last season, we didn't see anything for 7-8 days.
Was it Greenland you told me I need to go hunt at?
Greenland is something that we were looking. I was going to go try to find a place to hunt caribou.
Yeah. Was there loads? Were you there for jiu-jitsu or jumping?
Iceland is where we've been. Oh. Greenland, I haven't been. So there were caribou in Iceland. There is a hunting season. I don't know much about it. But when we were there, for whatever reason, I started looking at Greenland, and they have like full hunting packages there. And I think both would be amazing. But caribou just looks like a majestic animal to me.
I've had some friends go to Greenland. I get the two mixed up. Yeah. But supposedly it was awesome. One of my buddies, Justin Lee, went on a cool hunt that he just said it was freaking really fun.
All I have is internet information to reference, but everything I've been able to find on the internet was pretty badass.
Well, even when we went to France, that was just the diversity, just having something different.
Yeah.
was awesome.
That trip was awesome. It was.
At some point, we do need some to go get revenge, though.
Those fucking chamois.
I know, but we could do it.
It's not often you get a guide that does yoga and a red Speedo in the morning in front of the fireplace.
Dude, I thought they may have started red.
With plastic Scarpa boots on.
But they were, it was more of a pink. At least my angle, because was he facing you or facing away from you? Because I was.
Both.
Because you and I were across the rooms just kind of lacing up.
Yeah.
And then he just kind of came in to start getting some calisthenics and some stretching in. I think I had the Texas shot.
Yeah.
The Texas heart shot.
He was.
It was a little bit more pink undies in the back.
Yeah. Yeah, I had more of the plums and banana, I think. But that man was comfortable in a really small amount of clothing. Far, far more comfortable than I would be wearing what he was wearing. Yeah, but that trip, I mean, what, did we each get one shot?
Well,
at a ridiculous distance.
Yeah,
where the animal was probably 6 to 8 yards away by the time the arrow landed.
Well, think of the conditions. Like, by the time it started raining, then it converted to snow, then it warmed back up, then it froze hard in a rock, then you finally got there, and then it rained, and then it froze again. So it was like... it was like ice on top of deep snow. So yeah. Like when there was a guide, me, you, and a camera person like hiking around these hills, like you could have heard that from at least 2 miles away.
I still laugh at Mustachio. He seems to be doing well. He's continued in his hunting career. I follow him on the gram.
Do you?
Yeah, but he'll never live past the reaching back and feeling his calf days.
I know. That was so awesome.
For the self-order kiosk at the McDonald's.
I've never seen someone more excited to see a McDonald's than that kid was.
We put miles in on that trip, though, too.
That would have been fun. Like, I didn't realize that... I didn't really realize that true, like, Russian boars... like, because those were real razorbacks, those hogs that came
I
up.
I heard that one. I never saw it.
It had legit hair on it, like a labradoodle, but also a mohawk, like Glenn Plake.
And tusks?
I don't think I got to see the tusks, but it definitely would have by the height of the ridge on the back and the size of the body. That thing was huge. It definitely would have been a tusker.
Why didn't you shoot that thing?
Well, we were that was like probably our best shot. Opportunity at that chamois. Remember, it was straight across the canyon, but it was bedded, and we were kind of just like waiting it out. And then we heard the rocks like clicking and stuff, and that's when the group of like razorbacks came through. But we were like, just stay quiet, don't wreck the chamois hunt.
Oh, that's not what I was going to do. I had knocked up, and I was going to shoot when I saw it. Well, I never saw it though.
Get
out. All I heard was the rocks.
Yeah.
No, if it had moved, it would have gotten shot.
I mean, that's some rough country to live in. The French Alps, to just be up there as a hog, just like running your life.
Yeah.
Have you done any hunts out of a helo yet for hogs?
No, I don't know if I'd actually call it a hunt out of a helicopter for a hog. It's more like target practice.
Yeah, but you know we'd do it.
Oh, 100% we would do it. I haven't done it yet. I mean, if the opportunity presents itself, I'll absolutely do it. But that's not something I'm going to like book a trip just to do that. Like, I get it. But if we happen to be in Texas and somebody's like, hey, do you want to? Of course.
Yeah.
I'm not going to book a trip from Montana to Texas just to go shoot an AR at a hog running around scared to death of a helicopter.
I would.
Of course you would. I probably would too.
I want to know, like, how do you lead?
Just a little bit in front.
But what about with a bow? Because I feel like with a whisker biscuit, you could get it done. From the helo blades, like what is that force like when you're...
It's a smaller helicopter. They usually do them out of like Robinson two blade helicopters, so there is some downward there is some downward what would it be, wind, I guess.
Thrust,
it would be,
I don't know.
I think the issue would be the pilot would probably have to get closer to the hog and then therefore the terrain and potential trees than they would want to.
Well, for sure.
That's what I'm saying. It could be done out of a helicopter, I'm sure. But if you look at a lot of those videos, it's not just wide open fields. They're kind of running in between like
weeds.
Yeah,
all the mesquites and crap.
Yeah, the pilot's not going to want to get that close. That's why with the long gun platform, it's just you can sit from a farther distance. The lead would be the same, though.
With AR, how much is your lead? Like, if you're...
I'd put it on probably the front shoulder.
So not a whole ton.
No. I mean, those things are moving at thousands of feet per second.
Did you ever, when you're on the teams, how much training did you do, like, on the little birds where you're, like...
A lot.
Where you're sitting out on the...
A lot. So when I was at the East Coast Command, we used exclusively the 160th, so that's their 47s, which are the big Chinooks with the two rotor blades on top.
Mm-hmm.
The 60s, which is a Blackhawk, people are familiar with those, with the long fuel, generally with the long fuel, mid-air refueling probe, and then the MH-6s are the little birds with the platforms on the side, and then the AH-6s are the attack platform of that. They have rocket pods and machine guns and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But quite often.
What? How fast are those little suckers? It seems like they're ripping pretty good.
100+.
And if they're going that, is your lead, how much is your lead
vary?
You're not shooting
when they're going that fast. So you are, if the helicopter was like moving at 12 o'clock, your left shoulder is at 12 o'clock with them. So you're rotated sideways on the seat. So
okay.
The drag is, because otherwise you're eating that in your chest.
Yeah.
You're, when you scoot all the way up to the front to one of those platforms, you're kind of shoulder to shoulder with the pilot inside. And
oh,
it's
okay.
Amazing to see the manipulation of the controls they're doing. That thing looks like it's dead steady and the guy is just fucking up there working three axes and feet too.
Yeah,
like airplanes, like I can fly.
Is it
airplanes.
both feet
oh yeah, left pedals? And right, left okay. And right pedal, because you're fighting the torque of the tail rotor,
right?
Up down, like, so all three axes, yaw, pitch and roll. So as the helicopter, like transit mode, not, it's not what it's called, but would be, you're facing, like, if you're on the right-hand side or the starboard side, your left shoulder would be forward if you're on the other side. So you're just basically like tucked up against the skin, so you don't have a lot of wind hitting
you. Yeah.
As you get closer to where you're going, the helicopter packages will start slowing down because they don't come in and land at like 100. So
yeah.
As they slow in, usually at about 1 minute, I would generally sit up in the front right. You rotate facing the same direction as the pilot, and I would just lock my legs in front, and then you're just sitting facing with a good shooting platform.
Are you like on a little chair or something that's like out
the
edge?
So you see that cardboard box?
Yeah.
Probably twice that length, but about the same width.
Wow.
Yeah. So you can get three people on there. It's pretty tight. Two is quite comfortable.
I mean, and is that the main seating for the bird?
The little bird, yeah.
It is.
Yeah. It's just a platform.
So that's actually where you're being. That's like your seat on the bird then.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to. It's not like assigned seating, but that's generally where I like to sit.
How often would they use those specifically to like come in and cover? Or is that just main? Are you mainly just in that gunner position?
As they're coming to set you into where you're going to go.
So that's mainly just a position where you're able to protect more so than
you're able
assault?
To, you're able to. So they're going to probably, I mean, they have been used in my experience as a sniper platform that's flying around. And you would be sitting in that position where you're facing forward more than likely. You probably have somebody who is behind you covering more of the flank type area. But I was never at the sniper cell there, so it was an insertion platform. So the 1 minute out there slowing down, you can see a lot of times they would mark the building you're going to land at.
Yeah.
So you could see where you're going to land. So you just rotate.
This is nighttime for you guys, for
yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
So you rotate forward so you can see more. You unclip at the 1 minute out. And as they slow down, it just allows you to, when the skids hit the ground, you can just run off of it.
How are you clipped in?
They called it a screamer. No, it's not a seatbelt. It was called a screamer. That's at least what I use. So we had a very thick webbing belt, and on that belt there was a loop, and basically it is. There was a portion of it that felt like it was a bungee.
And then a fall break, that would be a rip break.
If it took a dynamic load, it would extend but stop.
Yeah,
and then so that carabiner would go to the back, like the little belt loop. In the middle of my back, I would just hook it there. And
yeah.
So that's it. You from the belt to a hard point in the helicopter.
Oh, okay.
But at a minute out, it's not that this has ever happened to me, but sometimes, you know, maybe you forget and you try to run off the helicopter. It's a little embarrassing. Touch embarrassing. So
I would do that all the time.
I have
now
learned.
You
you're just like,
it.
You're like, oh, fuck.
I'm that
go,
guy.
Like, go back and unclip, and everybody's looking at you just like, dumbass. So, yeah, at the 1 minute out, you unclip and just would put it back on my belt.
Did you ever, like, when you saw someone unclip, would you ever clip someone back in so they would do that?
No, I never thought about that overseas. That would have been excellent in the training environment, but it's a short tether. You would feel somebody messing with it. It's not, I mean, it's really, it goes from the front of your waist to the middle of your back, and then your clipping point is right there.
Did you ever have to do any cover from one of those guys?
Where shooting out of a helicopter?
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. It's
how vulnerable are you when you're doing, I feel like if I was on the ground taking cover and I saw one of those.
How would you see it?
I feel like it would be pretty easy to pick some people off out of it, depending on your weapon.
Well, you have to assume that you don't have night vision goggles. That you don't Yeah, that you have a weapon system that at best has iron sights. That we probably are going to show up in the middle of the night when the illumination is the lowest. Maybe on a cloudy night where there is no external illumination. So you might hear us. Pinpointing where that is pretty hard.
Is it?
Yeah. Unless you can see at night.
How many people can now? Like, how much is...
Tough to say.
How much has warfare changed now? Like, if you had to go do your same thing right now, you think it'd be just dramatically different for, like...
It's hard to say.
Casualties on our side, or how much better have we got with updating the technology?
I'm detached, man. I've been out of it for 10 years, and I make no effort whatsoever to try to stay in touch with what they're doing now. I can see on the internet, you know, you can kind of, you know, there's supposed to be mechanisms in place where that stuff doesn't get shipped overseas. Let's just say that there's flaws in every system.
Yeah.
So.
How is it not?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It would be unlikely, and it would be unreasonable for you to plan as if that is not a threat. And even the older generation night vision stuff would give you, it's better than trying to look and see something naked eye in the middle of the night where you can't. I would have to imagine that threat has emerged a little bit. But I mean, tactics can shift your tactics. Maybe don't land right at the compound. You know what I mean? There's things that you can do. And we started doing that even when I was active way, way back in the day. And again, I am incredibly dated when it comes to the tactics that were used at the time. But, you know.
Yeah, you had some commando-looking gear for sure.
Early on, for sure. And, you know, it's like, hey, we kept getting to these targets and there's nobody here. I'm like, huh, that's weird. Let's put a ISR platform up overhead and see what's going on. Like, 15 minutes before we get there, it's the Afghan 500. They're just, no, 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 no. I'm like, oh, they can hear us. Yeah, that checks out. Maybe we should find a quieter way to get there, you know. Surprisingly, results changed.
Yeah.
So, and that's the thing. I mean, you have to modify it. The technological advantage helps for sure. It existed in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'd have to assume that the enemy is going to evolve. Otherwise, they would no longer continue to exist. So it would be tough, you know.
If me and you could go back to your East Coast team.
Yep.
And you could show me one weapon, what would it be? Like, if you're like, dude.
What would you like the best? You would probably like the javelin.
I know I would.
I know. Who wouldn't, right?
Yeah, who would?
If you didn't, I wouldn't let you be my friend.
How heavy is it?
With the Clue, which is the launching system and a tube, a fully loaded tube, I think it's about 45 pounds.
Well, that's not bad.
It's not, which means you can carry two.
Yeah.
It's not that bad. The, what would be the technical term? The juice is worth the squeeze.
I think that is a technical term.
I think you would like the most a fire and forget heat-seeking missile. I think that would be your jam.
What's the lamest coffee order you've heard at your store? Have you ever heard anywhere you just like look over and you're like, what?
I've heard some that don't sound like English, where they take an order on, you know, we have a very traditional Black Rifle coffee, like, ordering kiosk with it. Most coffee shops are the same. Like, the standard in any coffee shop is a latte. And they start ordering stuff and adding things and modifying and start asking for a kind of milk made in a certain way. And I honestly, it sounds like a different language. Yeah.
A milk made in a different way.
Yeah. Of course, right now the term escapes me. But it's like, it's steamed and foamed half and half. I forget the name of it. Yeah. And then there's the psychopaths who like decaf, and I don't understand that at all.
Well, I need decaf after a certain hour.
I just cut my caffeine off at noon every day. That is one thing that I started. It was, what is it? The 10-3-1. 10 hours before trying to go to bed, zero caffeine. 3 hours before going to bed, zero food. An hour before bed, try to cut off all screen time. That has actually really helped.
Wait, say this again?
10-3-1. 10 hours before you're going to try to go to bed, zero caffeine. 3 hours before you're going to go to bed, stop eating food of any kind, just to give your... I tell you what, man, one of the main things, that's why I actually am wearing this watch, post-surgery, I've been, really been trying to track a lot of health metrics. The difference, the visible difference and the metric difference between when I eat right before I go to bed, where I give my body time to digest, is light, night and day.
In what way?
The sleep is much more restorative because you're actually, you're not digesting and breaking down the food.
Son of a gun. So I'm like...
10-3-1. 10 hours before, no caffeine. 3 hours before, no food. 1 hour before, no screen time.
Mine was 0 for 3 out of that.
Yeah, 0-0-0. That's yeah. That's also a varsity level strategy too.
Yeah.
So you could go 0-0-0-5. So caffeine, you know, zero caffeine, you know, up to going to bed. Eat whatever you want to. Screen time, and then have 5 cocktails.
Some, okay. Okay. I didn't hear the 5 part.
That's the, it's, this is a more, I'm not advocating this for people because your sleep metrics are going to be like shit, but you'll have a good time.
Okay.
You will not wake up recovered.
I've got to the point where typically I'll have like 3 mugs of coffee. So, I mean, that's like, yep. You know, I'll have
back to back to back.
Yeah, I'll do. So, I mean, it's probably like, I don't know, it'd probably be equivalent to like maybe 3 espresso shots in each one of those. So I probably have like 9 shot Americano by late morning.
Okay.
And then I'll kind of like go and grab a handful of nuts or something throughout, like through the day. But I usually don't eat till about, at least right now, I haven't been really feeling like I need to eat till about 5 o'clock or 6 at night. But then I...
Even from waking?
Yeah.
Are you trying to intermittent fast and put yourself in that window?
I actually just love... I like how I feel that way, but I like strap a serious food bag on for 3 hours. Like at night, I will eat
so
4 meals.
So you eat a
meals.
Lot, but it's in a really compressed time window.
I eat 4 meals in 3 hours.
See, this is something you should talk to your buddy Peter Attia about, because I'm not an expert at any of that
stuff. I haven't mentioned it to him because I don't know if it's PA approved.
Well, there's only one way to find out.
I actually just love how I feel that way. My weight has stayed where I wanted to. My strength and my – honestly, so I started doing this. I downloaded this app called Mountain Tough.
Yeah, I had Dustin on the podcast not too long ago.
Oh, did you have Dustin?
Yeah, he's awesome.
Yeah, I love Dustin.
Durfendorfer.
Yeah.
One of the most complicated last names ever.
It was. I didn't realize it until he was in my phone just as Dustin, because we met at a Winter Strong, and he kept saying like, "Hey, let's get together and do some stuff." But I mean, I'm pretty reclusive typically.
Yeah.
You know, I like to work alone. I like to train alone. Normally, I've got a pretty small friend network. You know that. For like real, you know, day to day friends. But, you know, I was like, I called him up the other day and I just said, "Hey, I'm in the phase where I want to try something different." Because sometimes I have to do that to stay sane. I need a training regimen. And it doesn't, sometimes it's in archery, like the year where I had to shoot a mouth tab, like I was so hyper focused on training that way that it's kind of satisfied just a disciplinary thing. And then honestly, for like the last 2 years, just self-teaching guitar has like really quenched that. And then now
you would love jiu-jitsu, dude.
I know I would.
You can't,
my master. Shoulder can't do it.
Like, it can. You just have to be careful. You need the right training partners.
I'm so close to both being gone. Like,
let's blow them out, dude, in spectacular fashion.
I will, but not when, like, the archery community, like, trust me, I'm going to have a jiu-jitsu belt, but it's going to be when I'm, like, 70.
I watched a guy get his black belt in his mid-60s. There's another guy,
dude,
Travis just gave a black belt.
I'm totally cool with that. I would love to, like, start that. I wouldn't have any problem starting that journey when I'm, like, 55.
You would just like it because you cannot master it. And so it would keep that.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd like that.
It would
drive me nuts.
No, because you're very, like, I know you well enough. You're very athletic. You would pick it up quickly. But the more you pick up, it's just like archery. We've talked about this before. The first time
in your afraid I'd forget too much. Like, I feel like by the time I went to the class the next day, I would have forgot what I learned the first day, and I'd been like, 100%. Wait, what's a shrimp?
Yeah, then you just get fucked up. It's awesome. The very first time that we did a lesson, you showed me how to actually shoot out on the grass out in your house. I remember the very gross, meaning not like disgusting, but very broad coaching you were giving me, because I was not capable of understanding what you were talking about if you had layered onto it.
Yeah.
So I've been doing jiu-jitsu now, I think, for 5.5 years. And almost every week, something will come up, and I'll say to myself, how have I not seen that for the last 5.5 years? I've heard it talked about.
Yeah.
And most of the time, at the gym I train at, there's an hour of class setting with a lot of drilling, and then we go into open mat. The teaching setting and the stuff that they're teaching, I understand that. But literally last week, Travis was teaching something, and we went into open mat. And for the first time in over 5 years, I remember thinking in the moment, oh, I could do that right then. I had rolled plenty in the last 5.5 years. I had never I had never seen or probably looked for the opportunity to do it. And then one day it clicked.
Yeah.
Which is awesome 5+ years into it that you're still having that. And then I ask him, or you ask a lot of these black belts, the more stripes they get on their belt, you know, the first stripe is so they've had their black belt for 3 years. The second stripe means they've had it for 6 years. The third stripe means they've had it for 9. And then I think this next stripe after that is like 5 years, then 7. So we're talking decades.
Yeah.
You talk to them, like, hey, how long did it take you to master this? And they're just like, ha, 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 ha. It's just a bottomless ocean, which I think is cool. I will say this. Your shoulders, if you pick the right training partners, you'll be okay. Like, I'm a relatively banged up person. We all are, just from life at our age. I have seen some injuries on the mats. I do know of people that have questionable.
I got my throat broken the first time on a mat.
That was Jocko's
that
fault.
That still changed my voice.
Yeah, that was Jocko's fault, 100%. He utilized a philosophy of extremely limited ownership on whether or not who was responsible for that.
I think it was a bonding moment.
Sure, if that's what you want to tell yourself. And again, I have
been doing jiu-jitsu. Dude, I have a picture of you and Sharon with the biggest smiles on your face, knowing that was happening. You guys are in there, and you're just like, dude. You're like, dude, what's that crunching?
So
I don't know. I've never been down
in that
here
room
before
with you guys,
with a gorilla on top of me.
And Victory MMA, which burned to the ground almost, by the way.
I know.
Recently. Sitting there, I had been doing jiu-jitsu for a couple months. I didn't understand what he was doing. And now, understanding the hammer fist choke, and have done it to a lot of people, holy.
I think it's an Ezekiel choke, right?
No, because you guys were in. You can do a no-gi Ezekiel choke. He took his fist and he put it on top of your Adam's apple. And
yeah.
What happened is, there was two things that happened.
I remember him turning it.
He was applying pressure, but you.
So was I.
You linked arms and pulled him into you, which. And again, I am not an expert in jiu-jitsu.
I think I broke my own throat.
No, Jocko broke your throat. I am not an expert in jiu-jitsu, but let me just say this. Your instinct in that moment was wrong. And quite frankly, he could have probably picked a submission with lower consequence.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
I just felt like I felt like I was collapsing. I felt like I was confident for like.
No.
Maybe 3 seconds, dude, when the wrestling portion was going.
It's not fair. If you encounter a grappler and you've never grappled, you are so proper fucked. It's not even. You just are.
Very true.
Yeah.
And I just thought, what's the worst thing you could give this guy right now? And I'm like, space.
Broken neck.
Just take the space out of this situation. You'll be just fine.
That's what grapplers want.
Yeah, well, he loved every second of it.
Yeah. Yeah, he could have, let's just say there was other roads he could have gone down.
Well, now when I if someone comes to the house and they can play guitar, because I'm not even good. I just drill a lot. And for me, just drilling and just trying to remember what I've learned without forgetting it is just therapeutic.
No.
But there's times where someone will come and they'll play and it's like sounding awesome. And now I've got to the point where I can look at it. And if I could sit in front of that person, now granted there's definitely like levels of chords and progressions that that I don't know for sure. Like, there's way more of those than what I do. But there's times now where when I'm watching someone do it, I'm like, well, I can do that. I know I can do it. I've just never done it in that, like,
sequence.
Yeah, exactly, like that sequence. So when you're going to, like, a jiu-jitsu thing now, and they're, like, saying, like, okay, we're going to talk, I don't even know the terminology, but are you seeing stuff that would be, like, you know, a coral belt level, but you're like, oh, I know what's going on.
A coral belt is like 30 years as a black belt.
I know.
That's what I'm saying. Probably an on average 10 years to get your black belt, so that's 4 decades. I can understand the gross concepts. Those people would see things.
So are you still seeing things? If you went to a jiu-jitsu tournament with just solid black belts, are there how much would you be watching that and just be like, what did he just do?
I understand. Like, the UFC makes a lot more sense to me now. It didn't make a lot of sense to me when I was watching it. And I actually had no interest in it before I started.
During the slow times, because you don't know, like, what the delay is?
When they're up against the wall or people are yelling at them, stand them up.
Yeah.
I totally agree with Joe when he's like, fuck these people. He doesn't say that, but I feel like that's what he means in his heart.
Yeah.
They just don't know what they're seeing. And inside, I know his inner voice is just screaming, fuck you. Because the micro battles that are going on there,
yeah,
it is holding somebody up against a wall, like the leg position and swimming for underhooks and inside position, or being on the ground when somebody it's a turtle, or they're kind of like on all fours, their forearms are on the ground and their knees are on the ground, and you're on their side and putting that weight on them and just sagging and exhausting. I mean, I know it doesn't look that exciting, and for anybody who wants to yell at the TV, stand them up. I just challenge you to go and grapple with somebody like that for 2 minutes, and it is exhausting. Like,
yeah.
They're not resting down there. The technical micro battles that are occurring are unbelievable. And so if I went to a black belt-only tournament, which I don't know if there are any of those, but I would understand all the gross concepts. I might not understand the sequence that they particularly use to get to whatever finish that they use, but I understand the concepts broadly.
So, like, with Leah, do you know there's stuff she's just not going to tell you?
No, she's not like that. I have not actually encountered...
Or is she just... is she learning, like... Because at her level, is she learning new stuff to where... I don't know. It kind of seems like at what point when you've been in decades,
yep,
are you like learning new stuff to where...
Not all coaches are the same. So lineage is kind of a big thing. And again, I'm talking, I understand for people listening, I don't know shit about jiu-jitsu. I'm repeating things that I've heard people who've been in the sport say for a long time. So lineage, you know, it's if you start with, there's a whole argument about where jiu-jitsu came from. Japan or Elio Gracie and the influence between and all this stuff, and I don't care about any of that. Let's just assume that it started with Elio and the Gracie family, and shockingly enough, the Gracie family doesn't always get along with each other, even though they share the last name. So there's a splinter, you know, and there are gyms now that, you know, are under American black belts, right?
Yeah.
So the farther it goes down the tree, the teaching philosophy is not the same at every one of those branches.
For sure, yeah.
So a good example, the gym that I train at, SBG, Straight Blast Gym, my coach's name is Travis Davison. You've met Travis many times.
Yep.
His coach is Matt Thornton, who's actually about your size, fucking huge human being. His coach is Chris Howder. Chris Howder is, I think, part of the Dirty Dozen, meaning the first 12 American black belts to get their black belt.
Okay.
Pretty sure he got his from Hickson.
Okay.
I think, I may be wrong on that. He may have even got... No, I don't think he got it from Elliot. Very close to the root of the tree, though. So the jiu-jitsu style is very similar from anybody kind of underneath that branch that comes from Matt to Travis, because Travis got his black belt from Matt, right? So their jiu-jitsu is similar. There's another really high-level coach, Henry Akins, who got his... He was Hickson Gracie's fastest black belt. I think he got his black belt in... 8 years. He's been a black belt for 20 plus years. Jiu-jitsu, right?
Yeah.
Got a black belt from a Gracie, but his jiu-jitsu feels, it is very pressure oriented, very fighting oriented, and you can arrive at the same end state, but it feels completely different when somebody's coming at you with it. So
I felt that way with 10th Planet. Because I rolled at 10th Planet a few times.
Yeah. So there's all these.
It seemed very different than SBG.
Sure. And I don't. And I'm not even remotely interested in people's arguments about what's better or worse. It's like, fine. You know, it depends on why you're doing it in the first place. B, if it's working for you, stick with it. If you enjoy it, keep doing it.
Yeah.
So somebody who's been in it forever, you can kind of like go and visit all of these other branches, and you might be learning a technique like the how to control somebody if they're laying down and you're on their side control. As a gross concept, not difficult, but in every one of those little branches, you might learn something completely different.
Yeah.
So that I don't think the learning ever really ends.
Yeah.
You might learn, like, hey, move your hand to this position instead of that. Not that what you were doing is wrong, but if you do this, this opens up three other options. And I hear Leah just got her third stripe on her black belt in Montana last year. So she's been a black belt for 9 years now.
Yeah.
Which is, there's not a lot of women three-stripe black belts. And every time we go to a seminar or work with a different coach, she says the same thing. She's like, God damn it. Like, I've been doing this forever, and I just, like, I feel like I just relearned it. Every time.
That's so pretty awesome. But the body is, you know, I think of how that relates to archery or, like, even a guitar. Like, you're comparing a technique with a static object.
Yeah, the guitar's not fighting you back.
Right. Well, and a bow kind of does.
The bow is under tension, though.
Yeah, the bow is
under tension. It's fighting you.
Yeah, it is fighting you. But I feel like it's more singular in how it does it. It's kind of like it's expanded or it's at rest. It's expanded or it's at rest.
But how many different ways have you seen of people who... Like, I don't know shit about archery, but I've seen some really fucked up ways people get to full draw.
Oh, yeah. Well, and the thing
fishing,
is...
the shoveling, and then not only getting to full draw, how they hold it. Like, I would never be an archery coach, and I had never...
You'd be a great one.
I would just be like, take that bow and put it in the trash with the other bows. You know, the releases that you use are very different than, like, the wrist releases. I had never been around Cam, and then I saw him holding, you know, the back of his neck with his thumb. I had never seen that. So think about all the different ways that people get to that, even just the end state of being at full draw.
Yeah.
Right, wrong, or indifferent. I'm the wrong person to talk to about that, but there are similarities. Like, they're getting to the same end state, but it's through a very different path.
So with archery, I just did this beginning archery series. Yep. It was like a 5 or 6 part series where I took a kid who had never shot, never even pulled a bow, and then literally in like less than 2 hours, I think in 90 minutes, I had him shooting, which Leah did the same thing. Mm-hmm. So did you. And then within 2 hours, he was shooting like way better than what he thought he ever would. Right. But part of what I always teach at the beginning of that is that there's always exceptions to the rule, and that I'm trying to teach a method that 90% or better of the population can actually duplicate. Whereas, like, I can tell you right now, if I tried to shoot like Cam, I would not be half the archer that I am.
Yeah.
Like, without question, he'd be better than me, because I could never progress as a wrist strap shooter. I was a puncher. I had high days. I had low days. When I had that type of technique, which is pretty common for people that just like go into an archery shop, and kind of the archery shop just kind of showed them how to be good with a bow in a few hours, you know, in 30 minutes, really.
Yeah.
That was kind of that method. But, you know, hats off to Cam. There's not many people, because I've watched him shoot. He doesn't have the yips. Like, he doesn't, at least around me, he hasn't had the yips. I would 100% have the yips. So he's like an exception to the rule. Yeah. And we definitely have that in like the target world. Like, there's high level target archers to where you're like, well, wait a minute, why is his shoulder completely compressed and he's got his hip hitched back and his elbow super bent and his arrow's like down on his chin and all up in his neck fat?
You can't replicate it, though.
Yeah, I'm like, 100%. Is he shooting world records? Yes. Can I teach you how to do that? No.
The parallels,
could I do that? No.
The parallels to jiu-jitsu there are huge because you'll see, and again, not that I'm anywhere near being a world champion, this is in conversations with high-level black belts, you'll see people who win world championships because they're so good at their game.
Yeah.
If they can funnel you to the beginning of one of their pathways, you're done.
Yeah.
If they can get you into their A game, you're going to get finished. But it's not – you can't teach somebody their A game and expect it to work like it's going to work for them.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, they're at the top of the heap, but you may never and likely will never get there if you actually try to replicate what it is that they're doing.
Yeah.
But you can't take away the fact – like, you did – you're the world champion. But I don't know if you could ever actually teach that as part of a curriculum.
And it – I don't know. It seems like at least in the archery world – it's pretty rare that when there are, I mean, technically I would refer to it as like a breakdown in a technique. Maybe it's just, let's just call it an exception to the technique. Normally an exception to a technique comes with limitation of how many different formats that will work.
Yeah.
Because in archery, it's like, okay, for example, someone that has like a hitch, you know, where like that front hips forward, which you've seen like women and kids do that a lot.
I do it
and
sometimes like too when I'm tired.
I do too.
Nice little sachet.
And like the front shoulder really collapsed. A lot of people can get away with that type of technique when they're on like flat ground indoor shooting, yep. But that technique, it is ultra rare to see that technique in a world-class like field archery type setting,
let alone hunting with an uphill shot where you got to stuff
exactly
it through a blame,
exactly like. in those places that really breaks down, even like how some people weight their bows, you know, it's like if you're shooting 30 arrows in 36 arrows, you know, two practice ends and 10 scoring ends of three indoors with perfect lighting, no foot variation. Like, you can put a lot of shit on your bow, like stabilizer wise and counterweights and stuff, to where it'd be like with a rifle, right? Like, you could set up a 300 Win Mag with like a bull barrel and everything to where it would just be a freaking rock,
yeah,
at a fixed thing. But would you carry that through a tactical course?
No, probably not.
It'd be a nightmare, right? Yeah. It would be a nightmare. Well, it's the same thing.
It would have no tolerance to the wear and tear that a tactical course, let alone a real world hunt, would have.
Yeah. And so that's where that stuff starts to happen, where it's like, and I guess the opposing view to that, which is, if I'm honest, counterproductive for what I really would love the archery community to be like when it comes to technique and form and stuff. If you do have an exception to the rule and it's specific to a certain format, like for example, hunting, way less numbers of shots, you know, especially when you're talking one or two arrows. To be able to mimic one or two arrows is very different than mimicking 30, and it's entirely different than mimicking 144. You know, like when I did like the 30, 50, 70, 90 meter stuff, mm-hmm. 144 arrows. Well, that shuffles the deck to who's still there at the end of the day. That shuffles the deck way differently than a 30 arrow pass or a 72 arrow pass. Then you go to 144, it's like, okay, well, this is a totally different day, because then so many other variables are factoring in, you know. I actually just did a video, I don't think it's posted yet, might be posted by the time this podcast comes out, but I did a video just on that I'm a minimalist mentality for tack. Like, when you see me hunt, when you see me do tack, I'm not very weighed down. Like, there's people, yep, that go to tack that look like they're getting ready to do a 14-day backcountry hunt with like no communication and no food, and then they're like, by the end of the day, they're like, yeah, I don't know, I lost a bunch there at the end. And I'm sitting there thinking, well, and did you develop a worst case of target panic too at the end? Because like when you're that spent, that's when you really start to have like breakdowns. And what I found, when it seems like no matter how hard you work on perfecting a technique, if you do it like one time the wrong way, why does your brain pick up on that way more than the other 100 times? Like on a guitar, I'll work on like a pattern and I'll go so slow that it's just boring. And then I'll try to pick it up. And then all of a sudden I'll try to go at like a speed that like even a decent guitarist could do. And then all of a sudden I, you know, do a finger in the wrong order or something. Then all of a sudden your brain's like, oh, that sounded like crap. Watch this. I'm going to keep doing that every time he tries to go fast.
I think we're hardwired for negativity. It's the same thing on social media. You could see 99 positive comments and one negative.
And I wonder if that's what it is. It seems then, like that way. It seems like, you know, you go to a TAC event, you can have, well, any archery event, you could have 20 awesome arrows, but then you've got five left at the end of the day. You're totally spent. You've been putting too much stuff on your back. You didn't hydrate, whatever it is. And next thing you know, you make one real turd shot. And then all of a sudden, like, here's the demons on your shoulder.
Yeah, you can't remember the good ones. The ones where you had excellent everything from setup to stance, target acquire, you break the shot, and then, yeah, you have one bad one, you forget all the good shit you just did, and you, yeah.
And your brain wants to duplicate that one. And see, with me knowing that, that's a big reason why I have a minimalist mentality, because I want to be able to make the same shot on my last two or three arrows as what I was able to do on my first two or three. And so I know by like weighing myself down less, honestly, having a bow that's like, you know, well, that's my tack bow right there. I built it this morning. I honestly took my tack bow from last year. I did like a half-ass refresh, and then I started shooting it, and I'm just like, I felt like I was fighting it. I'm like, dude, this guy does not like me. So I literally broke the whole thing down. Like, it looked like a bomb went off in here yesterday. Broke the whole thing down, restrung it, put a different set of limbs on it, and just literally built it from the ground up for, like, no particular reason. But then all of a sudden, it agrees with me again. But I need something that's better when I'm crap than being awesome when I'm good. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I mean, you were probably that way when you guys trained. Were you trying to see what would let me be the best when I'm just absolutely freaking smoked?
I mean, a lot of the times you would, in the training scenarios, you would go to that point of being absolutely smoked. And so, I mean, it's interesting. People will say, well, we need to train to failure. And it's actually a concept that I disagree with, unless you're going to highlight one particular thing with that failure.
Yeah, I'm curious on this philosophy.
Well, training to failure without a purpose behind it is just idiotic.
Without a purpose behind it. Is that the key to that statement?
Yeah. I mean, anybody can create a no win, impossible to succeed scenario in a training environment. Mm-hmm. And one of the fastest ways you can do it is you just reduce the amount of time they have. Like you can always create a no win situation. The more important question is why, you know? So like training to failure, it would happen, but a good example would be like a junior leader who is struggling with being able to prioritize important information, because all information has value, but it's not all important in the moment, right? Like you're getting shot at and the sun's out. Cool. That's great. I mean, maybe I should wear some sunscreen, but get behind this fucking rock first, yeah. Right? Like which one of those should you do first?
Yeah.
Both are valuable, but they're not both important in the moment. So, and I saw this happen so many times. It was a very basic tactical problem, and the elements will start to maneuver, and there's one person who's generally the senior leader is going to be making the call on the battlefield. And in these training environments, as a cadre, you can kind of start interrupting their thought process and just asking them stupid questions to the point where they lose control of what's going on in the element.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a failure. Like, everything grinds to a halt, or all their people get killed, and you're like, okay, stop. How did that happen? Well, I lost track of what's going on. Why? Well, I was trying to answer your questions. why the fuck were you answering my questions? Like, why weren't you paying attention? And you'll see it, the light bulb goes off in their head, like, oh. The next time you try to ask them questions, as if you're not even there. So you're highlighting like one particular issue in the failure. If I just throw a no-win situation at people and they fail and they fail and they fail, all they end up doing is getting frustrated. So the training we did was very, very difficult, because I do believe that you fall to the level of your training. You don't rise to the occasion. So
yeah, I agree.
You need to understand, like, at your worst moment, and it's just, you say this all the time, the range that you can sit out here in your yard and plunk arrows into the pump of a elk on a sunny day with no wind in the mountains of Utah, you better cut that sucker in half.
You
know, like, there's a difference between range time and then like hunting time. And that's, you know, your heart rate, you're probably going to be moving quick. You're going to be trying to get into a place of concealment in front of the animal, or like get all these things to play out that all have to happen sequentially for you to even get a shot off. That shit's not happening when you're standing out in front of a foam animal.
Yeah.
So you can try to replicate those things in training, but if you just make yourself fail and fail and fail all over again, I don't think there's any value there. You just need to understand how you perform at your most stressed, tired condition, because more likely than not, that's where real life is going to push you to. And if you don't have any understanding of that, stand by for a journey of exploration.
Because there's like different mentalities for training to failure. Like, some people feel like if you're training to failure, it's a negative, you know, it's like negative reinforcement to just fail.
Unless there's something you're highlighting.
Yeah, I feel like if I'm that weak mentally, I probably need to work on other things. Because sometimes I want to know where I'm failing, because that's, you know, and that's honestly why I'm like a minimalist when I hunt. Because I'm like, dude, I'm going to be more likely to make a good shot on a bull when I've got a 2,700 or less backpack on my back. And if I need to walk further out to get my good backpack,
yeah,
I'm like, the difference between hauling 40 or hauling 80 and then having to make a shot at the end of the day, I know that I am so likely to fail with this, you know, combination. I would be way better off having a combination to where the start and the finish can have the same outcome. And if I need to then add some extra work at the end to modify what, you know, what got me there, I feel like I'm better off doing that.
Yeah, I think simpler is better. The less stuff you're relying upon, also the less issues you could potentially have in the moment of truth.
Because you really have to factor in, when I really don't think I don't have any left, it seems like that's when the opportunities actually happen. And you're usually not able to really think it through. So, like, you have to, if you're overcomplicated to where you have to mentally think through every single thing and it's not a secondary reaction or a subconscious reaction, I feel like people are setting themselves up for, like, a really horrible experience.
Well, no piece of gear can replace the amount of experiences that you are relying upon to make it second nature. Like, I don't give a shit how awesome your laser digital peep sight is. You know, if you have never shot that in a moment of near maximal heart rate after, like, sprinting up a hill to get in front of an animal, and you can't even hold it on the animal that you need to, you know, be lazing, let alone pulling back on. And then, of course, the cable can come out at the most inopportune time, and then you have absolutely no idea how to shoot your piece of equipment. If you've gone through the time and trained with it and put it through its paces and understand those things, not that I have any – I can't shoot those, actually, in Montana, because it's considered – well, it is electronic. And, I mean, Nox weren't even – lit Nox weren't allowed in Montana for
the first couple of years ago.
Which is wild. And so the bow, what would it be? The sight, I guess it would be, that I'm talking about. Any digital ones are not allowed in Montana. But, you know, also the conversation of, even if it was allowed, do I want to rely on something that requires a battery? You know, I would, you know, take a little bit more analog with the experience of being in that moment over pushing a button and hoping for the best.
Yeah, that's a subject that I've brought up, because there's certainly a product that needs a battery to run. And I mean,
rangefinders need them too, right? And I rely upon those, but I can also eyeball it pretty good from 100 in.
Yeah. Well, my binoculars have a rangefinder, and I have a rangefinder,
yeah,
by the way.
There you go.
Because I've been there where one doesn't work because there's fog, and then all of a sudden another person's actually does. So, you know, I've kind of got a backup plan established for a reason. Remember when we were in Montana and I kind of took
when
that
I broke
bull.
That bull's shoulder?
Well, no, I was talking about the one where me, you, and Barklow were all doing a DIY together.
Oh, angry Barklow.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he had good reason to be angry, but
he's
I mean,
angry
we were
right
three
now.
For three on a seven. We were 3 for 3 on a DIY.
Yep. He's angry right now wherever he is, though. So.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. For sure. But like his came down to
the last 5 minutes of light.
The last 5 minutes. And honestly, it was to the point where, like, remember that bull that was there? He's just like, dudes, Andy, you got to leave in 2 hours.
Yeah.
He's like, Dudley, your flight's at freaking 5 a.m. out of Bozeman. He's like, we need to bail, but that one bull. And I'm like, no, bitch, you're freaking hunting until dark. Like, you're going to kill this bull. And I'll be damned if he didn't freaking make a sweet silverback shot. And I'm talking, that dude had got after it that day, because yeah,
that was the day we called him up to the top of the mountain.
Yeah, because I'm like,
and then you shot his bull.
I mean,
which technically was your bull, because you were there and he was not, but he was definitely trying to get there.
I'm like, dude, I don't know. I wanted everyone to get a bull but me first. And you know, and I'm like, just get here, dude. Just get. We couldn't have waited any longer, though, in all fairness. It's not like we were watching it, like, feed in a clover field or
no,
something.
No, it was actively looking for you and, like, walking up to that hilltop.
I'm like, bro, I go, bro, you got – I'm like, we're not going to call it this thing, but it definitely hurt us, and it's slowly coming. If you can get here – like, you're going to kill this thing. We'll just stay quiet. And then next thing you know, it just pops up on that rock at 10 yards. Like, either we dusted it or...
If we hadn't shot and it had not seen us, what do you think it would have done?
I think it would have just went into the bedding.
On the other side?
Possibly, but our wind was literally blowing within 10 yards of where he stopped.
Yeah.
Like, if he would have said, screw those guys, and then went that way, he would have winned us, and that was over. And I mean, we struggled on the front end of that hunt.
Yeah.
I mean, we struggled seeing anything, but then when he got there, I mean, he was all lathered up. He had definitely put in an effort.
Well, he came from the bottom of the hill, as did Barklow.
A long way away. Yeah. And then we packed that thing out of there, and then we got back to camp. Then we packed camp. And then we broke your bull down, my bull down, loaded those things, and then we're like, hey, there's 2 hours left of daylight. Dude, let's try to get your bull. And then when we shot his bull 5 minutes before dark,
yeah,
he's like, great, now what? And I go, we're going to be heading to the airport about 2 a.m., bro. But his training is what, you know, that's what allowed that to happen, because that was a brutal day for him.
Brutal
no
day,
question.
Shot at last light. He did not laze the distance. He made a call just by looking at the animal with a silverback.
Yeah.
Yeah. I still can't believe you coaxed that thing out of that tree line.
He was
the
not
quietest
he,
of the little reeds.
He knew that he saw two grim reapers standing side by side next to the smallest cedar tree, and he's like, man, she sounds good, but I swear I feel like I'm going to get shot if I come out of this. And he's like, look, he's like, dude, it's over. Don't worry. I'm like, shut up. I'm going to call this thing out of there. And then when he made that one turn, I'm like, just pump this sucker, dude. Yeah, that was freaking awesome. Well.
And then it was happy Barklow for like 5.
Yes.
But then he was angry.
Yes. Hey, so if you're listening to this podcast, we don't have all the details at this time. But
we have very few details.
Very few details. But Andy and I are together for a really good purpose and a good event. And today, what is today?
Friday. The 5th.
Okay. It's the 5th. And on, let's see, which Friday, one Friday away from now is when the podcast with you is going to come out. Exactly. Okay, so on the 12th, Andy's Cleared Hot podcast will launch. I'm sure this one will be barely after that, but I would recommend you listen to Andy's podcast from Cleared Hot, and we're going to be talking about, we're going to have a, there's a 7-day window of time where you'll be able to buy a raffle ticket or a group of raffle tickets for either yourself if you qualify, or you can buy them, and if you win a portion, there's two different awesome parts of this. So we're doing this very cool thing for a very good purpose, and it is for the Helping Heroes Foundation. Andy and I are doing a salute to service banquet tonight.
Tomorrow.
And oh yeah, it is tomorrow. Yeah. And we are going to be doing a really cool raffle. You're going to get a knock-on custom build if you win, and the winner will also get a governor tag to Iowa for a hunt.
Which is ridiculous.
Which is ridiculous. So you'll literally get, this is for a knock-on custom bow build. You're going to also get an Iowa non-resident deer tag. But there's one stipulation for the deer tag. You pretty much have to be, I don't know what the percentage is.
I think it's 100% disabled. I'm dead serious.
It is not 100%. I think it's more than that, though. It's over 50%, I believe. But you can also nominate someone. Or if you don't have someone to nominate and you're like, I just want the bow, but I'm going to let this person go, because they could actually use whatever weapon they want. They're going to bring them on a hunt. And then you're actually going to draw a tag this year too. So you and I both agreed, whoever comes, if they're coming during that first week of November, we're going to hang with them at the range for an afternoon too. So please look out for that. I'll put it on my social media. It's going to be on Andy's as well. Yep. There's a 7-day window of time. And the way we've set this up is you're literally just buying a raffle ticket. So you don't, it's not like highest bid wins. You're just going to, you're going to bid on that. But
highest amount of tickets though has the highest probability.
I don't know though. Freaking,
I mean, that's
old Brendable that won the Golden Trident bow bought one ticket freaking,
that's an
1 minute before the,
that's an edge case. Math works well.
Math does work.
I'm not going to pretend to know shit about math, but I feel like if you buy more tickets, your likelihood is better. And I think it's cool.
Some of these governor tags go for like big money.
Yeah.
I'm talking big money.
If you're not disabled though, don't let that hang up. It is cool. Like you said, you could get the bow, and if you could then nominate somebody else, like that's a win-win for everybody.
Well, or if you have a business, buy some tickets, literally win that thing, and donate all of it to a freaking amazing cause.
Yep.
I mean, agree. We have between, honestly, if you want it and you're like, I won this, which happens a lot, honestly, at TAC events, people, the person that won the TAC event last year, he said, I do not want this for myself. I want you to pick someone that 100% will deserve this and never be able to get it themselves. Those are also awesome ways to do it. So you could buy a bunch of tickets as a business, and then if that happens, heck, reach out to Andy, reach out to me. We'll even talk. We could talk with, you know, Black Rifle and be like, hey, do we have any of the disabled vets or first responders too? 100%.
We'll find somebody.
Yeah, no question about it. We'll find an awesome nominee. So good luck with that. And we're going to podcast for your Cleared Hot podcast here in a little bit with Clay. But thanks, everybody, for listening. Knock on. Thanks, Andy. Appreciate it. Miss you, bro.
Be sure to check out knockonarchery.com for our full line of custom design products, as well as free in-depth education and bow hunting entertainment to help you shoot at your best.